welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and coming up in just a bit, reporter Michael Ochterling of the North Dakota Monitor shares a story with us that he just broke today. It's about a growing communication crisis for many deaf and hard-hearing folks right here in North Dakota. We begin Main Street today recognizing that North Dakota's Superintendent of Public Instruction oversees the state K-12 school system, setting academic standards, administering state education funding, and ensuring schools meet their obligations to students. And for the first time in over a decade, North Dakota will have new leadership in this role. Governor Kelly Armstrong appointed West Fargo native Levi Backmeyer to the post earlier this month after Kirsten Basler left to take a job with the U.S. Department of Education. Backmeyer has worn many hats in the education world. He taught high school social studies with Teach for America, served as an education policy advisor to former Governor Doug Burgum, and most recently as the business manager of West Fargo Public Schools. He's known for his work on innovative education initiatives and being a trusted voice in K-12 policy. He will be North Dakota's top education officer at least until a special election in 2026, when voters will then decide who completes the term through 2028. Leading off Main Street today, we'll talk with Levi about how he plans to approach the job and cover his priorities and key challenges facing North Dakota schools, including the teacher shortage, funding for rural districts, school meal programs, vouchers and school choice, support for special education, and more. Levi, we have a lot to talk about, but welcome to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
First, congratulations on the new position. Can you tell us how the appointment came about? Did you let Governor Armstrong know that you were interested in being superintendent? Did he reach out to you? And then what motivated you finally to step forward for this role?
Yeah, absolutely. So I applied to serve on the State Board of Higher Education with an interest in better connecting our higher education and our K-12 system. That process, you know, led me to an interview with Governor Armstrong. We had great conversations about how do we ensure that we're retaining North Dakota students here in state, whether that's going in directly into the workforce or attending one of our institutions of higher education. So I was able and honored to receive that appointment. And we have had more or less just been in conversation since then. I've known the governor since my time working in the governor's office for then Governor Burgum, and just have always admired and respected the passion and intelligence that Governor Armstrong brings to the work. And so, you know, I had asked him, and he had brought up when we were discussing higher ed policy, that this was after Superintendent Basler had been sort of informed of her nomination. And it was something that I said, hey, you know, I would be honored to compete for. And so they held a, you know, an interview process, I believe, with several candidates. And I was honored to be selected. And I'm even more honored to be able to serve the students of our great state.
As I noted in the open, this is an appointed position and you'll have to seek voters' approval again in 2026 here. Have you decided yet whether you're going to run? And did you make any promises to the governor about running?
I mean, I have no intention in squandering the investment and trust that the governor has placed in me with this important role for just a very short time. So I haven't made an official campaign announcement yet, but I think it's reasonable that people should expect some news from me in the near future.
All right, let's get into what's in front of you, if we could, Levi, as you step into the superintendent's office. What's your perception now of the biggest challenges or opportunities you see for North Dakota's K-12 schools? And what are the first issues you think you need to tackle, or I guess key priorities you intend to focus on in the initial months? What's at the top of your agenda?
The top of my agenda is getting out and visiting schools and talking to school leaders and students and parents. I grew up racing go-karts all over the upper Midwest with my dad. So I'm no stranger to spending time in the truck. And I'm a firm believer of an adage I learned from one of my old high school football coaches, that you have to listen to learn to lead. I've got a lot of ideas and areas of interest about how do we improve student engagement and involvement in activities and community opportunities. How do we continue to move the needle on our proficiency in academic test scores. I mean, ultimately, with the goal of students graduating a choice ready with the knowledge, skills, and mindsets that they need to succeed in life after high school, but I don't want to be so presumptive that I know exactly how we're going to do that. And frankly, in a small state like ours, if we really want to move the needle for kids, it's going to take all of us. So I plan to hit the road, spend a lot of time in schools asking, you know, what's working, how can we do better together, and then figure out what's the best way to forge a path forward. So that's going to be my focus, in addition to getting to know and supporting the great folks who are at DPI right now. And I think you can expect, you know, just how am I going to approach the work? It's going to be a combination of high expectations, hard work, and common sense. And I think if those things can permeate our school system all the way down to the classroom level, we're going to continue to be a national leader in the educational experience that our students receive.
So as you initiate these conversations then, Levi, I'm sure you're going to ask a question similar to, these are the challenges that I perceive. These are my top two. What do you think? And what might those challenges be that are at the top of your mind right now, that the toughest challenges ahead for North Dakota schools?
I think it's ensuring that we have a shared definition of success. I think schools do so many different things that I really want to make sure that we are all rowing in the same direction. Some of those things are going to be really easy to measure. You know, traditional standardized proficiency tests, you know, percentage of students who are engaged in an extracurricular activity or job. I mean, some of those are pretty straightforward, but also others, you know, in a world is continuing to be changed by technological forces like artificial intelligence, how do we stay ahead of the curve and ensure that students are equipped with the skills that they need to succeed in our economy? Because the world's changing whether we like it or not. And I think by sort of sticking to, you know, the basics and understanding some of those foundational skills that has made North Dakota such a successful place to live and build a life is the exact same skills that are going to be necessary to adapt to a rapidly changing world. So I'm going into this with sort of the dual, you know, belief that we need to adapt, but you can only adapt well if you're doing, you know, the fundamentals, the basics really well. So I'm hoping to get out and just understand from these communities, you know, if we wanted to be world class in five things, what would those five things be? And try to get a sense of coming to some sort of shared definition across the state, because I want to make sure that all our schools are pointed in the same direction and the legislature understands what their priorities are and how they're trying to graduate choice-ready North Dakotans. And again, I think that just ties back to, we ask schools to do so many different things that one person's perception of the quality of our schools may be based on a very different set of metrics than someone else's. So I'm excited by the prospect. You know, North Dakota is it's a small town with long roads. And I really view this role as sort of the chief trust building officer between our schools and the legislature and our communities. And so I intend to dig in, ask, you know, hard questions, and figure out how do we all move forward together.
North Dakota, as you know, like many states, is facing a teacher shortage, especially in certain subject areas and rural regions. And you've, of course, emphasized that recruiting and retaining quality teachers will be a priority. But we know there are already programs in place to encourage people to go into teaching. But keeping them in the profession here in this state is tough. About 1 in 3 North Dakota teachers leave, as you know, within their first 5 years. Why is that?
Well, I think you'd have to ask the teacher that's leaving, you know, the field. Everyone has their own individual reasons for making a career change.
What's your perception?
Generally speaking.
Generally, yeah.
I think generally it's a combination of compensation and workplace demands. So I think those are two areas. You know, it's got to be more than teacher pay, but I also see where we rank nationally and understand that we've got a good-sized gap between the average bachelor holder and the current teacher. And so trying to find ways to continue to move the needle there to retain teachers so economics don't have to drive, you know, decision-making and force them out of the classroom. But at the same time, make sure that we are doing all that we can to support the good work that's happening in our classrooms so teachers feel supported and empowered, which is why you're not going to hear a laundry list of things that I intend to have forced upon schools. I mean, we really need to take a collaborative approach. I see this in a big district that I've been working for a while now. Our superintendent is deeply committed to our students, and she knows that if we're going to move the needle for thousands and thousands of kids, it takes engagement of teachers and principals and parents and everybody to ensure that there is buy-in in the work that we're doing so we can all, you know, row the boat in the same direction. So I'm planning to take that same approach and apply it here as I work to engage all of our 168 public school districts across the state.
I'm sure that you've seen surveys that educators have taken in North Dakota about job satisfaction. What strategies do you think you have for retraining especially highly qualified teachers, especially in rural areas? We've talked about that already in this conversation. Rural areas are different, of course, than where you've been recently in West Fargo.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important that people know that I'm no stranger to rural education. I started my career teaching high school social studies at a small school on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, and I was the only social studies teacher in the school at the high school level. You know, I had six different subjects that I was prepping every day. And so I'm no stranger to those realities of sometimes feeling like you're on an island. You know, there's going to be no silver bullet to this problem. It's one that, as I think you mentioned earlier, has been around in North Dakota for a long time, and it's one that we're not going to solve overnight. I think finding ways to help teachers be more efficient in the work that they're doing so they can really focus on direct coaching and feedback with students is one way to ensure that teachers feel like their workload is sustainable. And I think we know from research that, you know, direct feedback provided from teachers to kids is one of the highest leverage practices that helps promote learning. So, you know, as a business manager, you know, efficiency is sort of embedded in everything that I do. And I sort of want to take that same approach because we just hear from teachers again and again, we've got so much on our plates. And I think that that's true. So how do we move some things around? How do we, you know, potentially adjust the way that we're doing some things so it's not only improving outcomes for students, but helping teachers feel like their workload is sustainable, because retention in any industry is important for long-term improvement. There's certainly a cost to continual retraining, recruitment, and onboarding. And so I think part of this is, how do you retain the people who have raised their hand and said that they want to work in schools to begin with? Because to your point, if I was unaware of the fact that it was as high as 1 in 3, I know nationally it's you know, closer to 1 in 2 that don't make it to, you know, the 5-year mark. I think there's different strategies that you employ to recruit, and there are different strategies that you employ to retain. Some of those overlap, but I want to hear from rural school leaders what they're seeing and figuring out how can we work with the legislature to address this issue, again, knowing that there's not going to be any one silver bullet and that we're going to have to continue to sort of attack these problems from multiple angles.
We're enjoying our conversation with Levi Bachmeier. He's been appointed by Governor Kelly Armstrong earlier this month to be North Dakota's new superintendent of public instruction. More about rural schools, if we can. Levi, you mentioned that North Dakota has 168 school districts across the state. Many of them are small rural districts. Some education leaders have warned recently of an impending cliff, and I'm using that in quotes for rural schools in the state. Aging school buildings, insufficient funding to make it hard for those communities to educate their kids. What message, if any, are you going to bring to policymakers relative to the importance of sustaining rural schools? And are there any different approaches that you have in mind to assist with perhaps the school funding formula or how infrastructure is supported?
Yeah, I think that's a really big question. I think learning from school districts that are small, I mean, we have such a wide variety in levels of spending across our 168 school districts. I really view this job as a connector. And so finding school districts who are doing well financially, that are moving the needle for students. During the certificate program that I participated in, it focused a lot on ROI superstars. So who's generating successful outcomes for kids and doing it in a fiscally efficient manner. So I think the answer is talking to school leaders and teachers in districts who are doing that really well and finding ways to connect them with school communities that may be struggling a little bit on either or both of those fronts. You know, rural education is just foundational to our culture as a state, and we can't have students sitting on the bus for, you know, 2 hours each way to get to school. Are there ways that we can always do better from a resource, you know, sharing standpoint? how do we reduce bureaucracy and cut, you know, unnecessary administrative costs so we can pay those teachers well and keep those resources in the classroom where they help move the needle for kids. I'm interested in having that conversation with all schools, and especially our rural schools, because I think part of it is making sure that the funding is sustainable, but also understanding and implementing the best practices that are already out there in the state more systemically, because we've got some rural schools that are doing some really great things. And I think that's the best path forward. It isn't going to be, you know, someone from Washington telling us. And that's why I am appreciative of, I think, the increasing focus of the federal government getting out of the state's ways to determine what, you know, educational needs and values exist for each state. I think that that's a great thing. And so I think it's talking to the folks who are doing it well, because we've got countless examples of success across North Dakota in these rural communities where we've got kids who are learning and thriving and figuring out how do we make that as consistent in all corners of our great state.
I want to talk about school meals for kids. Do you believe North Dakota should aim to provide free breakfast and lunch for every student, regardless of income?
Yeah, I mean, I think directionally it's where we need to go, absolutely. I'm also, you know, cognizant of financial realities, and I want to make sure that we're also continuing to invest resources in our schools directly. But I don't necessarily view this as an either or. I think it's a both and. You know, with oil below $60, which is the largest, you know, tax revenue generator in the state, I think it would probably be optimistic to assume we could go all the way to universal, you know, meals in the very near future. But I appreciated, you know, this past session that the legislature increased the income threshold for students who qualify. And I think we just need to continue that march until we get to that point that all students are included. Because I think, you know, whether you look at the student performance data, just what we know about the importance of nutrition for academic success, and the fact that it essentially serves as a tax break for families with children. And I think, we're not talking enough about the fact that we're actually seeing a decline in birth rates. It's more dramatic nationally than it is in North Dakota, but it's here also. And I actually just saw some information this morning that suggests that this is going to be the first overall decline in student enrollment that we have seen in quite some time, with the exception of the year immediately following the onset of the COVID pandemic. So I think there are some interesting things that we need to talk about as a state as we chart a path forward. But I certainly think one of them is continuing to bring more and more students into that meal program. I think it's one of those issues that North Dakotans, I think, speak with an almost unanimous voice based on all the polling that I've seen. And if we can send a message to young adults in North Dakota that this is one less thing that you have to worry about financially if you're wanting to start a family, I think it's just a win-win-win opportunity.
On to the topic of vouchers and school choice. Levi, North Dakota, of course, is now allowing its first charter schools to start operating, which you've said, I believe, can serve as centers for innovation as long as they play by the same rules as public schools. So given that, where do you stand on vouchers or similar programs, and how might such programs impact public education in North Dakota? You've heard, and I've heard from teachers, that this is perceived perhaps as a threat to public education, and now you're in charge of carrying the torch for public education. What are your views?
Sure. Great question. So I think I'm right with the majority of North Dakotans based on all of the sort of survey and polling data that I've had access to. North Dakotans want more choice for kids. They want them to have more options in classes. They want them to have more varieties of activities. They want to be able to demonstrate their learning in different ways. They want to engage in different career opportunities that help young people understand what their skills and occupational passions are. So I think, you know, I don't like, you know, choice as a political football that's inherently good or bad. I think choice is something that no one should be opposed to. The question is the choice, is it fair, and is it equally accessible to all students? And so that's, you're referencing the comments I made, you know, at the press conference where the governor announced his selection. I agree with Governor Armstrong trying to find ways to empower parents and provide more choices in our public school system. I think is good for kids. And frankly, it's good for educators to be able to help unleash and develop the passions of young people. But I also supported the governor's veto of an effective voucher bill this spring because it falls short of that standard of ensuring that more choice was available for all students. So that's sort of the lens that I am looking, you know, through. I think we need to continue to improve the options available to our students, but we need to truly ensure that it is available to all and not just some students who happen to live in our largest population areas.
Well, advance to the topic of special education, something I know you've thought about as well, and there's been national talk at times, of course. You referenced it earlier about shuttering the U.S. Department of Education or dramatically at least reducing its role. But that raises a question, I think, for many, for special education in particular, since much of special ed is governed and funded by the federal government. So if that department's eliminated or if federal education funding were cut back severely, what would that mean for North Dakota students with special needs? Would IEPs, for example, continue to be upheld to the same standards? How would the state ensure that those students are still accommodated and supported?
Well, I think it's important to note, and when we're talking about this debate, which I think is more sort of politics than practical policy, that the number of people working in the Department of Ed is an inherent indicator of the strength of the support that students in our classrooms receive. So obviously the title funding and IDEA-B and other types of federal supports are important for our most vulnerable students, you know, particularly those with disabilities and those low-income students. I haven't, you know, heard generally that there's a large appetite to eliminate those funding sources, which I think are important to empower local school leaders to figure out how to best leverage them to meet the needs of all students. So I think that that's important. The state has a role in ensuring that there's due process for all students who may not be able to access their free and appropriate public education. And so this is something that we need to ensure that there are safeguards in place, that all students have access to a quality education. But at the same time, you know, I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that what's really going to move the needle for kids in North Dakota is going to be the work that we do at the state and local level, and not worry so much about how many employees sit in a building in Washington, D.C.
Levi, you're going to be at the table testifying to lawmakers about school funding in North Dakota. And of course, last year, the per pupil, there we go, funding increase of only 2.5% for each of the next 2 years was below the rate of inflation. So the question becomes, do you believe North Dakota is currently underfunding its K-12 education system?
I think we can continue to work hard to ensure that we have the resources in our classrooms that is needed to achieve and be a leader in the nation. I really do believe, looking at the NAEP, which is a national, you know, the nation's report card assessment, that we have, you know, one of the strongest school systems in the country. I believe we can have the best school system in the country. And, you know, there's, I think, a consensus when you look amongst, you know, educational finance researchers that there is a correlation between spending and outcomes. And so part of my job is to advocate for continued investments in K-12, but it's also my job to work with and challenge these schools to maximize the return on investment for every dollar that is entrusted to us. Now, I'm a business manager, so I know there's only so much efficiency that you can gain, you know, at the local level, but I think it's a both and proposition. I certainly want to advocate that our funding, you know, meets and exceeds inflation, so teachers aren't going backwards financially when adjusted for inflation. But I also know that the state has made a dramatic increase, you know, since really the horizontal drilling revolution in, you know, the mid and early 2000s, first decade of this millennia. And I think we need to recognize and appreciate the legislature's investment. It's a very different reality than where we were 25 years ago. But at the same time, if our goal is to truly lead the nation, that's going to take investment, and it's going to take intentionality from school leaders to make the most of every dollar. So, yeah, I guess that's a long way of saying I intend to advocate for increased funding, but I also, you know, believe that just simply saying more money is not a guarantee. There's a difference between a correlation and causation, and so we have to do our job. That's, I think, part of this role, is to work with those school districts to ensure that we can go to the legislature and confidently say, this is what happens when you invest more in public schools. There is a return on investment. The legislature has an endless number of requests that it receives. I know this very well from my time in the governor's office and the large budget requests that come in. So we really need to make our value proposition to the overall well-being of the state known. And I think we've got a good story to tell. I intend to tell it, and I also intend to challenge our schools to take the resources that it has and continue to raise the bar for students.
My guest has been Levi Backmeyer. He's North Dakota's newly appointed state superintendent of public instruction. He's responsible for the state's K-12 education system, and we've talked about a lot from teacher retention to school funding to the future of public education in the state. Levi, best wishes to you, and thank you for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you so much for the invitation and the kind words. It's an honor to serve this great state.
Still ahead on Main Street, a story that just broke today in the North Dakota Monitor. It's about a severe shortage of sign language interpreters right here in North Dakota. That's ahead on Main Street right after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today we're looking at a challenge many of us might not think about: the shortage of American Sign Language interpreters in North Dakota. For deaf and hard of hearing North Dakotans, not having an interpreter readily available can be a major barrier, whether it's a medical emergency or in a courtroom or even at community events. Our guest is the reporter who recently explored this issue in depth. Michael Ochterling is a reporter for the Bismarck-based North Dakota Monitor. It's a nonprofit news outlet focused on state news. He's previously worked as a local editor and reporter in Minnesota. Michael wrote today's Monitor story titled, "Lack of Sign Language Interpreters in North Dakota is a Major Barrier," and he joins us now to talk about what he found. Michael, welcome to Main Street.
Craig, thank you so much for having me and for highlighting our reporting.
Yeah, it's a very interesting article. I told you off mic, I've seen interpreters at planned events, things like a news conference, for example. I never, ever thought about the situation that you begin your story with Tammy Derrick at a Bismarck hospital, where video sign language wasn't working properly and she needed an interpreter. Let's start right there. Can you tell us what happened in that situation and why it's a telling example of the shortage?
Well, I think it is telling because, Tammy is a member of the deaf community, and something completely, it could happen to anyone. One of her kids had a medical emergency and needed to go to the hospital and get to the hospital and trying to explain some things. And obviously Tammy is deaf and she needed a remote video assistance for the interpreting. So they tried to bring it up on the iPad, on the device. It wasn't working. They kept losing the service. It kept dropping out. And then they need to start the whole thing over again. And it was just becoming more and more of a hassle. And so Tammy's like, I would really like an ASL interpreter to be present to translate so I can accurately understand what's happening to my son and what's happening with his medical condition and how to remedy it. So
yeah, these could be life and death information that a parent needs in real time, and access to this service just sounds to me like it's critical.
It is critical, and especially when you're talking about life and death, like you're saying, and also complex issues. I mean, a lot of us aren't very versed in medical terminology and medical like procedures and stuff like that. The same could be said for different things involving lawyers or court proceedings. I mean, it takes like a specialized person to do those things. I mean, you go to school for a lot of years to become a lawyer or a doctor, but you're going to need equally versed interpreters to interpret those complex discussions so you can understand them and you can have equal access, which is provided under the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Tell us, Michael, how severe is the shortage of ASL interpreters in North Dakota? I was amazed at the stats.
Right. That was something, it was brought up in a committee discussion, the Human Resource or Human Services Committee. The North Dakota Legislature is going to be looking into studying barriers that members of the deaf community and hard of hearing community are faced with. And one of the North Dakota lawmakers, Representative Kathy Fralick, who from Devil's Lake, she works as an outreach advocate for an outreach specialist for the School for the Deaf. And she's also hard of hearing herself. She wears hearing aids. And so she got up and provided testimony, kind of laying out the situation that members of the deaf and hard of hearing community are faced with. And one of the things that just jumped out of her testimony at me is just like, in North Dakota, we only have about 15 nationally certified interpreters that can interpret American Sign Language. I'm like, well, that doesn't sound like very many. And then, you know, she goes on, she's like, and if you compare us to Minnesota, well, Minnesota has over 500, and they do. And you start thinking about, okay, 15 interpreters for a very wide state like North Dakota is, such a rural area where these interpreters are located. How are people accessing these services? And so we decided to dig in a little bit deeper on, you know, what happens in the interpreting field for ASL. And, you know, some of these interpreters do need to travel quite a ways, as you can imagine, to get to some of these events and different meetings and trainings and such.
It's almost like if you live in Western North Dakota, it's tough.
Yes, it is. I mean, west of the highway, Highway 83. Yeah, there are no certified interpreters that live in Watford City, in Williston, in Dickinson, or Medora. I mean, the two ASL interpreters I was speaking with are located in the Bismarck area, and they both said that they've traveled out to Medora to interpret the Medora musical. And so, you know, that's a couple hours in the car and, you know, there and back. And, you know, so, and with, you know, not having very many interpreters to begin with, it also limits us because they're doing something all day that requires a lot of traveling. And that kind of reduces the number for other services if people are seeking those at that time.
I want to put myself in your shoes. Help me understand what it was like writing this story with the assistance of an interpreter.
Oh my gosh. So Craig, I've never really encountered members of the deaf community or hard of hearing community in my reporting before. And so organizing a meeting with a couple ASL interpreters, that took some finagling. We had to make sure the interpreters were available because they both work in the public school system in the Bismarck area. And so one had to make sure they had a sub that could fill in for them. Another came on their free period. And so just organizing that interview was a little bit difficult. But then we got to the interview at the Bismarck Public Library in one of their meeting rooms. And, you know, we go up to the desk and it's like, oh yeah, we'll probably need about a half hour. And then, you know, one of the interpreters stopped. He's like, no, why don't you give us 90 minutes? I'm like, okay. And to tell you the truth, we used all of it because it just takes longer. It takes longer for someone who speaks to go to the interpreter and then through American Sign Language to the deaf or hard of hearing person and then back. It just takes longer. But it is also shorter than if we were to type everything out via email. If I wanted to do an interview just with text, I mean, gosh, it would take so long just to type out all the questions and have them type out the responses. So, I mean, having American Sign Language interpreters is critical, especially if you want to convey information quickly. And in those situations, like we were saying with a medical situation, vital that gets interpreted quickly.
Give me a sense of what their job is like. And I ask it from the perspective of the folks who bought our home in Cheyenne before we moved to North Dakota. She was an interpreter and I watch her work. It's demanding. It's demanding. And I can't imagine having to do that for 8 hours a day or longer. It's just tough. Put me in their shoes.
Oh, you know, I don't think I could accurately because I'm not versed in American Sign Language. But I mean, you're taking in your words, your conversation, and interpreting them. And then the other person is signing back and you have to then relay that back to spoken English. It's exhausting for the brain to do that a little bit. And even the interpreters I was speaking to, they said that, you know, they do sometimes need to plan breaks for their brain just to kind of provide some relief so it's not so, you know, go, go, go all the time.
Michael, how widespread is the problem? How many folks are deaf or hard of hearing to the extent that this is something they need?
Well, it's difficult to calculate, actually, talking with the people I did for the story. So in 2021, the National Deaf Center estimated that about 3.6% of the population of the United States considers themselves deaf or hard of hearing. Now, that may not sound like much, but it does equate to, you know, more than a million people. So, you know, and also some of the subjects I was talking to in higher ed at the School for the Deaf, they'll also point out that North Dakota is a very, has a high propensity of military veterans and also farmers and ranchers that may have been operating those big tractors and stuff without cabs, you know, and they lose a large portion of their hearing and can become very hard of hearing later on in life. And so it is kind of a an unknown and also a very transient population. They're moving in and out of state just like the rest of us are, for jobs, for family, for different reasons. And so it is kind of hard to pin down how many deaf people, how big that community is. But there does seem to be larger portions of the deaf community in North Dakota in Devil's Lake, where they have the school for the deaf. So people in Devil's Lake are probably more accustomed to seeing people using American Sign Language out in the community, and also Fargo as well. They're a pretty big deaf community in Fargo.
Enjoying my conversation with Michael Ochterling. He works for the North Dakota Monitor, where he is a reporter, and his story broke today titled "Lack of Sign Language Interpreters in North Dakota, a Major Barrier." And of course, you can read that online at the North Dakota Monitor's website. Michael, it seems to me that one of the root problems here is lack of training available in the state. For example, you can't go to any university or any college in North Dakota and become an ASL interpreter.
That's very true. There are no four-year degree programs for an American Sign Language major.
That surprises me.
We did have some two-year programs, but they were discontinued about 5 years ago. Lake Region State College, Minot State University had a partnership for a four-year degree during that time. You get your two-year interpreting degree from Lake Region College, and then you finish up at Minot State with some of the other higher level undergrad classes and basic interpreting history and some other things. But it wasn't very highly enrolled, and so when you have classes like that and you can't meet the bottom line, you know, those tend to be those courses and those programs that may be discontinued. And in this case, they ended up discontinuing that kind of partnership that they had and went to a one-year certification program. So you can still take American Sign Language in the state, but it's only a one-year certificate and some offshoot courses.
A term you mentioned in your article was low incidence. It's a low incidence disability. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, and trying to explain what a low incidence disability is was challenging. It basically means, and I'll put this in terms of special education. We look at special education programs around the state. You know, you have intellectual disabilities, you have speech disabilities, some other physical disabilities that require specialized education. Deafness is much lower. There are much fewer instances of that. And so when there's much fewer instances of something, it struggles to get the resources and different things necessary to kind of, you know, promote that. So
is that one of the reasons the legislature is looking at it?
Oh, I believe so. I think there's a lot of reasons they're looking at it, but definitely one of the reasons is, I mean, there's really not a clear-cut path in the state to, if I said right now I want to be a nationally certified American Sign Language interpreter, it would be difficult for me. I could maybe take the certification course. I could do some follow-on stuff, but I wouldn't be able to get a four-year degree in American Sign Language to be a nationally certified interpreter. You don't need to necessarily have an ASL four-year degree to be a nationally certified interpreter. You could do a two-year program and then some practical experience and kind of build up your experience hours like that to equate to it. But again, that can take time. So there's not really a clear-cut path for that national certification, which is required by the state of North Dakota. You need to be a nationally certified ASL interpreter to be conduct professional services, freelance or whatever. When we talk about interpreting in schools, K-12 schools, it's a little bit more relaxed. You can have paraprofessionals conduct some sign language and stuff like that. But even that, it's not that national certification level where you're going to go do government meetings or you're going to go to the hospital and work on call at the hospital and be available for that. You're not allowed to do that unless you have that nationally certified recognition. Same with court proceedings. There's only about 8, I think, in the state of North Dakota that are licensed to interpret court proceedings. And one instance that one of the interpreters told me about, the judges end up working around the interpreter schedule because they know that they're very, very busy. And so if they need those sign language services, they'll work around the interpreter schedule, not the schedule of the court as it normally would.
You talk about technology in the article, and it was mentioned during the legislative hearing on September 4th that you've also referenced. Where are we at with tech in becoming, well, we mentioned it right at the top of our discussion, right? The Bismarck Hospital was hoping that tech would fill the gap there. All of a sudden, it didn't work. So where are we at?
Well, in many ways, it's taken a big step forward. I mean, there are, you know, speech to text apps on everybody's phone. There's the video remote services that we were talking about earlier with connecting to a service, maybe not even in your state, that will connect you with a sign language interpreter they can communicate through the device. But again, it's not like having a live person there that can, you know, express emotion, and you can read nonverbals, and it's much easier to sign back and get your questions answered if you are a deaf person or a member of the hard of hearing community.
Yeah, that was my thinking with tech is, okay, I can record our conversation and get everything you said. How do I, as maybe a deaf person, speak back to you using tech without using ASL?
Yeah, it's difficult. And it's why I think some people do tend to want those professional interpreters there to kind of facilitate that communication, especially in serious matters.
So we know now that the legislature has taken notice of the issue. You talk about Representative Frelich's testimony, the work of the School of the Deaf. Where do we go from here?
Well, I think it's up in the air. Talking to the Lake Region State College, the Vice President of Academic and Student Affairs, you know, conversations with him, they do see the need to expand the ASL program back into a two-year program. But he was telling me first, really, it should start at the high school level with some dual credit options locally for kids in the Devil's Lake area. I mean, because you need to build that pipeline. You build that pipeline from high school and then into the college program that could maybe feed into it. And so maybe that is a way forward. Obviously, education on educating people on the barriers is another thing. But, you know, video assisted technology is going to play a role here because we are a very rural state in North Dakota, and not everybody, like we were saying, west of Highway 83. I mean, unless you book a interpreter in advance for, you know, if you're a business or a nonprofit or a hospital, or if it's an event or something like that, I mean, you might be relying on some of those video services to conduct that equal opportunity, communicating effectively that the Americans with Disabilities Act covers.
I want to circle back to the start of our conversation. People have now suggested that employees in various professions really need to learn sign language. Nurses, police, teachers, go down the list. You could add pastors, and there's more and more. What are those conversations like, and how have those ideas now been floated to maybe assist the deaf community in these technical professions, perhaps?
Well, that's also another one of the solutions, talking with the superintendent for the School for the Deaf. I mean, she says, you know, if we can't get nationally certified interpreters, we just need more people to learn sign language. And so you can be a nurse, you can be a doctor, and as long as you know sign language, you know, it's something. And something is better than nothing. I mean, it's not quite to the equal access that's demanded under the ADA, but, you know, it is something. And also it gets the foot in the door, and maybe you realize you like using American Sign Language and you want to take it further. It seems like it's a very in-demand career in this state. It could be. Talking to the interpreters for my story, they say every week is different. Super busy, book to the walls some weeks, and some weeks it's a little bit less, but no week is ever the same. So, you know, it is an in-demand profession. I just... not sure anybody really has an understanding about how we get more interpreters in this state.
Michael, in the context of communication, what does it mean to communicate effectively with someone who is hard of hearing or deaf?
Well, that's the question right there. The Americans with Disabilities Act that was signed in 1990, President George H.W. Bush, you know, it requires state and local governments, businesses, and nonprofits to communicate effectively with people with communication disabilities. Now, the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, they have a nice explainer on their website about what it means to communicate effectively. Now, it can be different in different instances. So let's say you're in a retail store or a restaurant. Those things may not require an interpreter. I mean, you can get by with writing notes, speech to text, maybe even as simple as pointing to something on the menu, or maybe even writing it out. Where it becomes a challenge is those state and federal government meetings, medical appointments, those complex court proceedings. The Civil Rights Division says an ASL interpreter, quote, generally will be needed in those instances to communicate effectively. And I believe how Ms. Frelich describes it in her testimony in September is, you know, if a person, person who can hear walks into a room and gets services, it needs to be the exact same if a deaf person or hard of hearing person walks in and wants the same services or the same information.
My guest is Michael Ochterlein. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us, Michael. It's been an interesting discussion for me. And of course, we're talking about his reporting in the North Dakota Monitor. You can read about the shortage of sign language interpreters that North Dakota faces and the challenges it creates right now by reading Michael's story in the North Dakota Monitor. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Greg, thank you so much for having me.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 27th. Eleanor McGurin never had a teddy bear as a child. Born in 1918 on a farm near Leonard, North Dakota, she became a teacher after college, and around 1945, she bought her first teddy bear in Fargo, adding a few more over the years without much thought. Eleanor taught elementary school and music. In 1947, she became the first teacher of the Brown Quadruplets, the first surviving set of quadruplets born in North Dakota. After marrying Mac McGurin in 1951, she taught in North Dakota and Minnesota before moving to Oregon in 1957, where she continued her career. Her passion for teddy bears began in 1976 after seeing a display at Oregon State University. By 1978, she had 50 bears. Running out of space, she displayed them at a local museum in Monmouth, Oregon, then bought a travel trailer to house her growing collection. In 1980, she purchased a small house and opened the Bear Den Museum. Every Friday, visitors could enjoy her collection of over 1,500 bears free of charge. By 1984, she had spent more than $5,000, nearly $16,000 in today's dollars, on bears, and the museum drew about 2,000 visitors each year. Eleanor also shared her bears with the community, donating to children in hospitals and traveling to schools, libraries, and clubs with a selection of bears. Her collection ranged from a bear less than an inch tall to Tiny Tony, a 7-foot giant. She had bears from Peru, Israel, the Philippines, China, Sweden, and Germany. Her most expensive was a limited edition Steiff teddy bear purchased for $150 in 1980. Concerned about the future of her collection, Eleanor arranged for its preservation. On this date in 1985, the Fargo Forum announced the delivery of more than 1,000 of her bears to Bonanzaville, USA, a history museum and village in West Fargo that had just added a 1,900-square-foot wing. The teddy bear exhibit opened in 1986. Eleanor kept a few favorites, including her $150 Steiff bear. Eleanor McGurin passed away in 2003 at the age of 85. Her headstone is engraved with a teddy bear. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents Masterworks 2, Music from Within, with works by Mozart, Stravinsky, and Bloch, and performance by Maestro Christopher Zimmerman on piano and Principal Flute Deb Harris. November 8th and 9th at NDSU Festival Concert Hall. Details at fmsymphony.org.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
And that's it for this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us. Tomorrow on the show, Dr. Tom Easern takes us back to the Gilded Age, when Dakota's duck hunters range from hometown sportsmen to high society travelers arriving in luxurious private rail cars laden with game and grandeur. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to seeing you again.